down to the dog. Kill my boy, my only son, my pride and joy. They shot my wife dead on the floor, holding our baby in the cabin door.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please, please don't shoot me down.
Down. Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down. Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please,
please don't shoot me down. And you wanna go build a cabin in Idaho, in Idaho. If you're living free, boys don't sell no shotgun, no deputy.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge. Please,
please don't shoot me down.
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 Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please, please don't shoot me down.
Kids on Ruby Ridge,
please, please don't shoot me down.
Down. Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge,
please don't shoot me down.
And that was Ruby Ridge, and that was done by Professor Eric Carlstrom, my co-host, and he's on the phone tonight with our guest, Alfred Weber. And before I get started here, this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida, and the views expressed by this on this program are those of myself and or my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. Are you there, Alfred and
yes,
Eric?
I'm very happy to be here with you tonight.
Yeah, and I'm here too, and it sure is a pleasure to have Alfred back on the show. We talked to him last fall and had an extremely interesting interview, so I'm interested in following up and hopefully taking it in some new directions. Could I start, Melody?
Yeah, go ahead.
I just wanted to start by saying that I've been working on this this unsolved murder mystery, 911, for quite some time. And recently, I've purchased an excellent 14-hour DVD called Science and Politics of 911, What's Controversial and What's Not. This is the proceeds or 14 hours of talks given at a conference that Dr. Jim Fetzer put together. He's the founder of Scholars for 911 Truth. He brought together some very excellent state-of-the-art speakers, and Alfred Weber was one of them. And, of course, we really haven't talked about your background this time. Melody, did you want to read your long list of Alfred's accomplishments, or should I just summarize here?
Well, I've got it here. Alfred Weber is an author, a lawyer, and a futurist, and a peace activist, and an environmental activist, and a space activist who promotes the ban of space weapons. He was a co-architect of the Space Preservation Treaty and the Space Preservation Act that was introduced to the U.S. Congress by Congressman Dennis Kucinich and is endorsed by more than 270 non-governmental organizations worldwide. He helped draft the citizen hearing in 2000 with Stephen Bassett and serves as a member of the Board of Advisors. Alfred is on the Board of Advisors at the Exopolitics Institute, is a congressional coordinator for the Disclosure Project, and is a judge on the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal, and is the international director of the Institute for Cooperation in Space.
Yeah, and I can add a couple things. He's has a doctor of jurisprudence. He's an international lawyer. He has a master's in education. And he, again, going back to this 911 conference, he gave a superb talk. I would like to really plug this talk. And I've now got a website called, it's a Google Pages website, so forgive me, it's a long one. But if anybody's interested, I'll say it, and perhaps you could jot it down. The website is http://2/ and then 911newworldorderfiles.googlepages, all one word, .com. So it's http://911newworldorderfiles, all one word, .googlepages.com. And if you go to that, you'll see that on the first page, I now claim that the who, what, when, where, why, and how of 911 seem to be apparent. At least I think they are. And I've put together a hypothesis. And if you go to the homepage, address will get you to the homepage. Then click on the first page. That's got my notes from the Madison conference that Alfred spoke at. And what is, I think, really special about Alfred's talk is that he answers the question of who and why.
Eric,
you know,
can I?
Crime has to have a who and why. So I'm very impressed that Alfred has come up with these answers.
I also wanted to plug Alfred's Exopolitics radio program, too.
Okay.
And that,
yeah, I was hoping we could get into his Exopolitics. He's got a book called Exopolitics, and is very active in that area, too. So hopefully we'll be able to span these topics in the 2 hours. But if would you mind, Alfred, if we talked about some of the issues that you raise in your talk back at Madison?
Oh, sure. Great.
Okay. Well, for those of you who jotted down the website, again, if you're really serious about wanting to know what happened and who did 911, you might just call that up and take a look at the notes that are on the first page that I attribute, of course, to the speakers. They included Dr. Judy Wood, who is a materials engineering professor, Dr. Jim Fetzer, philosophy of science, Barbara Honegger, who is trained at the Naval War College and is a Naval War College journalist, and then Alfred Weber, again, put together the why and the who. How do you know all this, Alfred? I'm amazed that where did you find this stuff out? I guess it's your background dealing with what you call the International War Crimes Racketeering Organization. Would that be why you understand?
Well, put it this way. You mean why in terms of the specific 9/11 event, or why generally, or?
Okay, here's what I have you saying, Alfred. You say, okay, you start right off, you say 911 was a false flag operation by this International War Crimes Racketeering Organization to provide, number one, to provide a pretext to engage in genocidal and ecocidal depleted uranium bombing of Central Asia, in other words, Afghanistan and Iraq,
right,
in order to secure the oil and the uranium. Then number two, to roll out a terror-based national security system worldwide. And number three, to implement the final stages of a world depopulation policy. So you're thinking much bigger than the most of the other 911 researchers. You're looking beyond 911 at the larger context here.
Yeah. Well, you know, you really have to go back to the roots of that talk. And the roots of that talk were my talk at the 9/11 War Crimes Conference in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, at the beginning of 2007, in February of 2007, where I was also became a judge of the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal, where we actually held a session of the War Crimes Tribunal, and there were seven prominent jurists worldwide, including an eminent jurist from the United States, Professor Francis Boyle of the University of Chicago, and a number of other jurists, international jurists, including the president of the Malaysian Bar and various other international jurists, and we held a day of sworn testimony with witnesses, including witnesses of U.S. and U.K. war crimes in Iraq and in and in Palestine and in other parts of the Middle East, including the famous man under the hood at Abu Ghraib prison who was there at this war crimes conference. You remember the fellow who was photographed on a crate as being under a hood, is a very kind of archetypal photo. Well, he was one of the witnesses.
Yeah.
And we also had a judge on the Tokyo International Tribunal for War Crimes in Afghanistan who was a witness. And in preparation for that war crimes conference, I began to think, well, if we're going to form a war crimes tribunal that's going to pierce the corporate veil, that is, go beyond the obvious sort of front men or puppets of Bush and Cheney and Blair at that time, the British prime minister, and get to the really apparatus, how is it that we're going to secure culpability? So it seemed to me that even if we go back to the classic article by General Butler, the man who the North American War Crimes Racketeering Organization, the DuPonts and the Rockefellers, attempted to recruit for an attempted coup d'etat back in the Roosevelt years. They attempted to recruit a General Butler, who actually went and reported the attempted coup to then President Franklin Roosevelt. Now, Roosevelt, you know, whether you can say, well, he had the judgment or not, he may have exercised judgment and chose not to prosecute the DuPonts and the Rockefellers at that point. If I had been sitting in his chair, I would have prosecuted I would have prosecuted them. I would have thrown them in jail, and I would have thrown them up on treason charges. And I think we would have had a vastly different 20th century. But that was Roosevelt's call, and it was only many years later that now the American public is dimly aware that there was even an attempted coup d'état by the wealthy and the rich in the Roosevelt years. I think one of the faults of the United States is that the public is even dimly aware that there exists an upper class in the United States that has successfully kept itself hidden from the public for all of these years. And I think that if you go back to some of the early sociologists, and please correct me, Professor, is it C. Wright Mills? Is that the fellow?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, the power elite.
Yeah, the power elite. Now, as I was growing up, because I've navigated many of the social classes, well, I used to summer on the estate next to David Rockefeller, and we had 5 yachts on our particular estate, so I knew how these bastards, excuse my language there. Whoops. I forgot that I'm speaking on public radio down in the United States.
That's fine. That'll keep everybody awake and interested.
Yeah, yeah. I, I thought I would jump them up. You see, part of the purpose here is really waking people up. All of the evidence exists out in the public that on September 11th, 2001, there was not only a national coup d'etat in the United States, there was a world coup d'etat, and the world public order was actually hijacked. And that's the condition under which we exist now. So to get back on track with your subject, as I was preparing this talk preparing and designing for the actually designing the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal, I actually wrote part of the constitutional statute of it, of the tribunal itself. It struck me that the essential thing that we had to do was to pierce the corporate veil and to get behind the two puppets, Bush and Cheney, and Rumsfeld, and kind of the operational people, to the parties that were really behind this. And one of the successful legal strategies that has been used in this area is the racketeering legal strategy, where you go after, where you sort of try to make what's usually called a conspiracy. You make that much more specific, and you call it a racket. You know, kind of like Al Capone and the liquor racket in Chicago,
right,
back in the
right,
good old days. I'm just sort of bringing in various images. You'll both have to excuse me. I was watching the victory speeches of Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama just before getting television time. And there's a little bit of kind of the virtual reality watching those two, but we'll get to that later. What we had to do in that task in preparing for that talk, which is really preparing the design of the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal, which was an effort to really try the permanent war economy. Because once you get to a model, you realize that war is an industrial activity. And under the permanent war economy, it's considered an industrial activity. War is the industrial activity and the product of the permanent war economy. And so we were out to try to identify and evidentially prosecute the principal actors that are engaged in the racket of the permanent war economy. And believe it or not, once you set your mind to it, it becomes a relatively easy task because it's an artificial economy, even though it dominates most of the world. So out of that flowed a model, and that model is a model which I can briefly describe. May I?
Go ahead.
Yes, please.
Yeah, okay. Now, we're going to get into an area in this description that is a little bit uncomfortable, but I want to say this, and because we're going to fall under the First Amendment of the Constitution of the United States, which I taught in the United States at the University of Texas when I taught a course on constitutional law and the Bill of Rights, and that is that government shall make no law to infringe freedom of speech. So I'm going to exercise my freedom of speech, but I'm going to use some terms that are not meant to offend any religion or any cultural minority. Okay? I'm going to use the word Zionist, but I'm going to use it in its political sense, not in its religious sense. So when I use the word Zionist, it is not meant to refer to any religious or cultural minority, but rather to a sort of a political party or a political conspiracy. And I want people to be very clear about that. And I have had discussions like this on the Air America radio network, and they were okay with it. So I assume that that's okay. Is that okay?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay, certainly, good. Yes. Yeah,
mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. But I just wanted to check so everybody is cool with it. We are not anti-Semitic. This is not a witch hunt of any religious or cultural belief system. We are talking about a very specific set of political actors. Okay, so what we were able to identify as the principal actors behind the permanent war economy were, roughly speaking, if you look at the North American branch, it would be what we called the Rockefeller Syndicate, or the Rockefeller Network of companies. Now, that has been studied and identified with a net worth of about $10 trillion. And it is intertwined with, if you look at the corporate ownership, it is intertwined with the families, and the corporate ownership and the families are intertwined with the leadership network of a secret society that was founded in 1832 on the campus of the university at which I attended undergraduate, at which I got my law degree, and in which I taught at the economics department, and that's Yale University. And the secret name of that secret society is the Brotherhood of Death. It's an offshoot of a German secret fraternity called the Brotherhood of Death. And the surface name of it is Skull and Bones. And Skull and Bones was founded in 1832. The current president, occupant of the White House, George W. Bush, is a member of Skull and Bones, as was his father, as was his grandfather, Prescott Bush. And Prescott Bush, together with another Skull and Bones Brotherhood of Death member, were the account officers of the Brotherhood of Death syndicate, who financed through the Union Bank, who financed Hitler starting in the Nazi movement starting in 1923. All of this is documented along with his Brotherhood of Death colleague, Averill Harriman, through the Harriman Bank and Brown Brothers Harriman. They financed both Hitler starting in 1923 and the Nazi movement, and they financed the Bolsheviks by sending over counterfeit plates. They penetrated the U.S. Secret Service and had counterfeit plates for printing U.S. dollars given to the Bolsheviks, factories, and other things. So that by the time the workup to World War II came along, which was a manufactured event, World War I was a manufactured event. It is estimated that John D. Rockefeller, who was the founder of the Rockefeller Syndicate, which was the Rockefellers are the leaders of the International War Crimes Racketeering Organization for North America. They are the principal Rothschild contractors. The Rothschilds run the world International War Crimes Racketeering Organization. The Rothschild Organization, out of the House of Rothschild, has been reliably, its worth is reliably estimated at $100 trillion through statistical studies.
Yeah.
These work exactly like crime syndicates. And through the science of public relations, they have made themselves the cream of the crop. But in fact, they're criminals.
Which is kind of interesting with these guys is that they not only are the ones that are running these criminal syndicates, but they're also running the philanthropic organizations.
Yeah, these are just fronts. For example, if you look at the Ford Foundation, that's a front for carrying out the depopulation in the third world countries through its population control programs. And my understanding, and we have good evidence that the AIDS vaccine was was developed as a bioweapon. In fact, there is one researcher who has found a line item for it in the U.S. budget. Was developed as a bioweapon at Fort Detrick, Maryland, sometime in the later 20th century, there were teams that were under the cover of civil society and non-governmental organizations with teams of U.S. Rangers is kind of along with them on a supposed medical mission, were deployed to southern Africa, allegedly to vaccinate against smallpox, but they were all vaccinated with the AIDS vaccine, and it was to kill off the African race. And that's why you have such rabid AIDS epidemics there now. It is not because of sexual transmission. It's because of what happened with these vaccines about in the latter part of the 20th century.
Aren't they vaccinating for that still?
I'm sorry?
Aren't they still vaccinating for that?
Yeah, well, the AIDS virus was hidden in the smallpox vaccine, which was then part of a covert operation, and that was undertaken by U.S. Armed Forces in Africa, collaborating with U.S. civil society organizations. So
Okay. So Alfred, if you talked about the North American branch in your talk,
and if we go over to the European branch, and we look at the UK, which is. The UK is the capital. The United Kingdom is the capital of the International War Crimes Racketeering Organization. And this, most specifically, if we're looking for a physical capital of it, it is in the City of London. The City of London is a 677-acre quasi-independent jurisdiction at the heart of London. It corresponds to the ancient Roman walls right at the heart of London, and it's overseen by a committee of 12 banks headed up by the Bank of England, and it's mediated through the House of Rothschild. And the House of Rothschild, as I mentioned, its net worth is $100 trillion. Now, the House of Rothschild is overseen by Lord Rothschild and the Rothschild family, and who are responsible, if we go back in history, for the implementation of a Zionist policy, including the establishment of the State of Israel and its genocidal policy in Palestine, where they went into a perfectly peaceful area which for millennia had accommodated three-faith, people of three-faith, Christians, Jews, and people of Islamic faith in Palestine had lived there peacefully, and through the Rothschild money and influence pushed through the establishment of the state of Israel as a to be a power move on the world stage and established a genocidal state, which has since committed genocide against the Palestinian people in terms of the land grabs there, and in terms of the you know, its theocratic prosecution of genocidal policies against the Palestinian people. The International War Crimes Racketeering Organization also carries itself out through satanic, Masonic networks in government, finance, media, the law, in government, in intelligence, in military intelligence networks, even reaching up to the royal family in the United Kingdom. And that is of significance because if you trace back, for example, the Rothschild interests own 80% of the uranium reserves in the world. They essentially own the world nuclear industry and 80% of the uranium. And right now, the world, the human race, scientifically, is being genetically depopulated, and its DNA is being attacked through the use of depleted uranium weapons by their use by U.S. forces in Afghanistan and Iraq, because the ionizing radiation from that depleted uranium takes only 14 days through the jet stream and the trade winds to make itself around the world. And already here in Canada, for example, the diabetes index has already exceeded the diabetes index expected for 2050. And a report just came out this past week that there are a very large percentage, I think it was 350,000, I forget, a very, very large percentage of U.S. troops who served in Iraq have mental problems and depression, and that's from permanent brain damage from exposure to the ionizing radiation of depleted uranium rounds.
When you say
Iraq, and you just have to go on the Internet and see the photographs of the monstrosity birth defect babies, not only of the Iraqis and of the Afghanis, but of the U.S. soldiers.
Alfred, when you say the Rothschild interest, that means you're taking in that they're the banker, the central banker for pretty much almost any organization and monarchy or anything of that sort, and that the Rockefellers would be a branch? Is that what you're kind of saying?
Yes, i.e., if you look at the entire money system, money is actually the private property of the banks. And so we are working inside their system. We are automatically indentured slaves of the banks. And the banks are all owned by the City of London. And now we're going through economic cycles, which are actually dictated by the City of London. The price of gold, for example, is set every day in London at the House of Rothschild. That's the price of gold worldwide. We are inside a very enforced system. If you look at George W. Bush and Richard B. Cheney, one of whom was a year ahead of me at Yale, Richard Cheney, one of whom was just behind me at Yale, George W. Bush, both of whom are sociopaths on their best days, psychopaths on their worst days, they actually work for the City of London. They do not work for the American people. Most of the world elite work for the City of London. Most of the shall we call it the bourgeoisie or the sort of the working professionals or upper elite professionals who kind of work for the matrix or inside the matrix, kind of work for, quote, the man. The man is the City of London. The man is the Rothschilds. We are in a planet that is run by the Rothschilds, and that's a fact.
This is tremendous insight, I think, Alfred, and everything I've read checks out just everything you're saying here. We've also had Eustace Mullins, who wrote The Secrets of the Federal Reserve, as a guest, and we had Edward G. Griffin. Is that his name, Melody?
G. Edward Griffin.
A couple others,
yeah.
Talk about our money system, and from what I understand, all of the nations of the world, about 190 of them, have a Rothschild-controlled central bank, all except for perhaps four. And I think these three of the four showed up on George Bush's quote-unquote axis of evil. That would be Iraq, Iran, and Syria. And at that time, they did not have a central bank controlled by the Rothschilds, which would perhaps explain why George W. Bush considered them to be an axis of evil. Does that sound right to you?
Yes. You know, and one of my that sounds very correct to me, and so I then, knowing all of this, I sat down in preparation for trying to cope with this, how to prosecute this International War Crimes Racketeering Organization. By the way, but just to complete the picture, if we go from the UK over to the European continent, there we can say that what we call the black nobility of Europe, kind of the Dutch throne, you know, Shell Oil, sort of the various satanic networks, the Vatican, all of those different knighthoods beholden to the Vatican are part of the International War Crimes Racketeering Organization, and this is an organism that has ruled the world since Sumerian times for perhaps 6,000 or more years. The Vatican, of course, is just an extension of the Roman Empire, and the Pope is a way that the Roman Emperor has survived. But it's all under the tutelage of the House of the City of London and the House of Rothschild, which is the banker to all of these various criminal syndicates.
Is it true?
And so that is why we chose the model of the International War Crimes Racketeering Organization, because it is a racketeering organization, and that's why we sought to go after it and prosecute it under the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal as such, using this version of the law.
Is it true that the cardinals were originally Roman senators?
Sure. You know, just using that particular model, if you look at when the when the Roman Emperor sort of morphed into the Pope, there's just a transition there. There are even some books that say that the four synoptic gospels were written by Flavius Josephus, who was the chief propagandist of one of the Roman emperors.
Oh, you mean they had propaganda back then, too?
I'm sorry?
You mean they had propaganda back then, too?
It's part of the human condition, which is where exopolitics gets in, which is, I believe, the truly liberating force that will get us out of this condition of war, disease, crime, and poverty that we find ourselves in, and this corrupt elite. One of the problems, essential problems of this planet, is that we have a terminally corrupt elite. That I think if you look at the figures of the concentration of wealth is far worse than any of us think. One of the problems is of the corruption of the elite. Exopolitics, I think, provides an avenue out of this conundrum. To stay with the 9/11 issue, it appears as though 9/11 first of all, from my analysis, and I first got into this area through the assassination of John F. Kennedy and that research when Congressman Henry B. Gonzalez, who was chairman of the House Banking Committee and was in the Kennedy motorcade, called me to Washington in the early 70s, in the mid-1970s, and I met with him in his office, and he asked me to help him form an investigation of the John F. Kennedy assassination. So that led to, about a year later, the House Select Committee on Assassinations, which was an investigation of the assassinations of John F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, and Malcolm X. And if you look at the assassination of John F. Kennedy and in 1963, and then the 9/11 event in September 11, 2001, they were both false flag operations, and the principles behind each were identical. If you look at the January-February 1964 issue of Time magazine, they had the Rothschild family on the cover. And it was prominently featured, oh, this is the Rothschild family, they're finally coming out. And that was their signature, we did it.
Yeah.
And the reason why the Rothschild family took out John Kennedy was that because he had the temerity to sign an executive order whereby the U.S. Treasury would print, would issue silver-backed currency, and he was about to terminate the Federal Reserve.
So what agents did he use, they use?
Sorry?
Who did the Rothschilds use as their agents to do this?
They used the U.S. government, which they owned. They used
okay.
the Central Intelligence Agency.
Okay, that's what I was...
The John F. Kennedy assassination was an act of the U.S. government.
Okay. I mean, I understood that, but
Marcus, it was 9/11 was an act of the U.S. government.
Both
were acts of the U.S. government. I mean,
yeah.
The National Reconnaissance Organization took over entire buildings on 9/11 just to make sure that the attack on the Pentagon went off as scheduled.
You know, Michael Collins Piper has come up with a book about the Kennedy assassination called Final Judgment, and he,
he finds a connection with Mossad as well as the U.S. government. And a lot of evidence points towards Israeli or Mossad complicity in the 911 operation. Are you aware of those connections, or have you thought?
Yes. I mean, the thing is that Israel is a front for the City of London, and at the political level, and okay. and so the orders for the Kennedy assassination and for 9/11 come down from the City of London.
And they're
carried out through Israel. They're carried out through the various organizations
intelligence
on the ground as needed. We have eyewitnesses placing Donald Rumsfeld planning 9/11 as early as 1971.
Right.
That's the degree of planning in this.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I think this is a slam dunk home run with the bases loaded talk that you gave Alfred. But it occurs to me that I really recommend that everybody go out and buy that DVD and watch these series of talks at Fetzer's conference. And I have an observation and then a question. My observation is that Jim Fetzer, of course, had been studying the Kennedy assassination for many years, and he was poised to understand what happened on 9/11 much sooner than the rest of us. And that's your situation as well, having been well-versed in the details of the Kennedy assassination. When 9/11 occurred, you were just ready to see the big picture much faster than the rest of us. That's the way I look at it anyway. Jim Mars, of course, same thing, and various others who have been researchers. But my question is, or my other observation is that, okay, you've identified the who and the why. You've identified the who, and you couldn't, or we couldn't, be up against a more powerful group of people in the world. So that's daunting, to say the least. How do you hope that we can overcome these incredible odds? The fact that they own the media, they print the money. They own the intelligence services. They run the military. They own the politicians. They've run the world for, like you say, a long, long time. I guess maybe this is our segue into some solutions and perhaps the role of exopolitics. Would you say that's appropriate?
Yeah. I think when I first started writing in the exopolitical area, one of my first articles was entitled something like "Exopolitics: The End of Ordinary Politics," and I think that's really the case, and ironically, probably one of the segments of society that is most once as we get into the exopolitical area, it's the elite that is most exopolitically aware, and that's what's most shocking to people.
Well, could you explain yourself? How is the maybe you could just back up and tell us a definition of exopolitics, and then tell us how the elite is more aware.
What this do you remember the Fire Sign Theater? It was something back in the 70s.
Yeah, I do.
Back in the last century.
Yeah.
And
it's going back, though.
Yeah, and their motto was, "Everything you know is wrong."
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that seems to be the case.
And what exopolitics forces us to do is to redefine our storyline. And essentially, what the elites have been able to do is to define our storyline, and that's how they keep everybody imprisoned.
Alfred, before you get into it too far, can you explain a little bit of your background and you know, some of the activities and organizations and schooling and occupations you had, particularly back in the 70s and maybe even, you know, prior to that and further, so
sure,
people get a
sure.
get an idea of what, you know, your background.
Yeah. Well, for those folks who want to know, I'm a typical five-planet Gemini. And I don't know if people know much about Geminis, but we're very... My mother, who was also a Gemini, said, oh, I'm polyphasetic. We have many facets, and we love to lead as many lives as we can, and we're all about communication. And so I have been into many different realms of activities, and crammed about as many lives into this one life as I can. And that's sort of my orientation toward life. So I'm both an attorney and a psychotherapist and a futurist. And what they say about attorneys is that, oh, yes, you're expert at taking people apart. And so I became a psychotherapist to be able to put people back together.
Mm-hmm.
As kind of, you know, being able to approach the individual's psyche, and a futurist to be able to deal with large systems and understand what our reality is. But I'm not sure. Here's my essential background. I'm kind of a child of the 60s, and that is a person who was deeply affected by John F. Kennedy, who I thought was he's the best president I've seen to date, and who was deeply affected by the Vietnam War. Because it affected all of us at that generation, and we had to fight against the Vietnam War. That is, those of us, it was sort of our political baptism, and to try and stop the obvious war of genocide that the U.S. was fighting in Vietnam. And that was our political coming of age at that time. And so that was my first
exposure
to politics.
You were also a Fulbright scholar in economic integration.
So I have managed to... that is, if we talk about my external life and my internal life, in my external life, I've carried on a very blue-chip, fast-track, you know, education and career of you know, the best schools. I mean, I went to Georgetown Prep School. I went to Yale undergraduate, Yale University, Yale Law School. I was a Yale Law School National Scholar. I was a Fulbright Scholar. When I came back, I went into the one of the most prestigious, the largest international law firm in the world. It was, it was populated by the people from the John F. Kennedy administration. I shared, you know, sat in George W. Ball's office. I mean, that became my office. He was Undersecretary of State for John F. Kennedy, and that was the type of person that was in my law firm at the time. And while I was practicing Wall Street law, I was simultaneously a corresponding attorney for the New York Civil Liberties Union, and I was one of the counsel in the Panther 21 trial in 1969, where the FBI tried to frame the Black Panthers, and I was genuinely there.
Was Daniel Sheehan involved with that too?
I'm sorry?
Was Daniel Sheehan involved with that trial too?
No.
Okay.
No. Gerald Lefcourt was,
okay,
was the main counsel there. But so I've always had kind of a 360 degree view toward the world, and never I identified with the interests of any particular social class. but rather with interests like justice. And so from there, I became general counsel to the Environmental Protection Administration. It was in the early 70s. I just want to keep track of the time and not put the focus on myself.
Well, I think it's kind of important for the next subject that you go into.
Okay. Well, at that time, it was the early 70s and the beginning of the environmental movement in the United States, and I was offered the position of general counsel of the Environmental Protection Administration of New York City, which I took up and became a crusading environmental lawyer. And that was a lot of fun, and we, passed some of the early statutes in air pollution, noise pollution, solid waste. Did you know that packaging is 40% of solid waste? I mean, I tackled all of this stuff and learned about the biosphere. I, met some incredible people and went, got all involved in the environmental and ecological area. And then Mayor John Lindsay decided he wanted to run for president, and I didn't feel like going that route. So I decided to leave government at that point, and I became a consultant to the Ford Foundation, and that's where I intersected with what eventually became exopolitics.
Did you also join the Stanford Research Institute too?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
It was that was later on. That was at the beginning. Jimmy Carter ran for president against Gerald R. Ford on the ground that if elected, he would open up the files on extraterrestrials. So I took him at his word and met both with senior members of his transition staff in Washington in December of 76 after he won, and then with other people who were Dr. Hal Puthoff and Russ Targ at Stanford Research Institute, who were running the remote viewing program for the Department of Defense. And I talked to them, and I met with the futurist unit at SRI and made a proposal that I wanted to do the first civilian scientific study of extraterrestrial communication in the Carter White House, because he had made that pledge. So I was offered a position there on that grounds, and then in the spring of 77, approached the Carter White House and became the director of the proposed Carter White House Extraterrestrial Communication Project, which was the first civilian study of scientific study of extraterrestrial communication. And we put together a very powerful project with White House, under the sponsorship of the White House. I would meet there with White House officials, and until it was abruptly terminated by the Department of Defense in October of 1977, who called a meeting with high officials of Stanford Research Institute and called me into it and said that if that program were not terminated, they would terminate all of their contracts with SRI, that is Department of Defense contracts, which at that point were about $25 million, which was about one quarter of SRI's total budget. So that program was terminated at that point.
Well, aren't a lot of the universities pretty well tied in, like with the defense contracts, anyways?
Yeah. Well, just to make it clear, at that point, although Stanford Research Institute had started out under the wing of Stanford University, it had become a separate organization, but you're quite right. America is a war industry.
with the penal industry as the secondary.
And the penal industry is part of it. So most of the, you know, the universities are kept afloat with all of these defense contracts, and science is co-opted in the service of the production of weapons and better ways to monitor and subjugate and incarcerate people and keep them from reaching their full human potential. What this whole thing is about, what the House of Rothschild and all the International War Crimes Racketeering Organization, all of this, the 9/11 and all this conspiracy, when you come down to it and it's deeply examined, it comes down to spiritual warfare. What that is that there's a certain category of beings, and there are structures on this planet which are attempting to keep the rest of us from reaching our full potential, because we have enormous potential, and from rejoining what is a fully populated and highly, extremely creative and expansive universe society that is out there and is actually surrounding our planet and waiting for us to be liberated. Right now, as we speak, and this is fully documented, there is a shadow war, there's a shooting war going on between U.S. Space Command and the permanent war economy and upper dimensional advanced ethical extraterrestrial society, which is here. And which in
Could you say that again, Alfred? You said that rather rapidly.
Upper dimensional advanced extraterrestrial society.
Well, I have two questions here. One of them is why did they pull the contract on Stanford? And then the other is what kind of proof do you have to back up what you just said?
Back up.
Meaning that when you're saying that there's this warfare going on, what?
Okay. So we're now fully into the second hour.
By the way, I've got to say, this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida, and this is Truth Quest, and we've got Dr. Eric Carlstrom and Alfred Weber, and we are into the subject on exopolitics. Thanks for reminding me.
So, Alfred, I know very little about this, and I don't know how much our listeners know, so maybe you can give us the basics of the premise that you have here and the evidence to support that.
Okay, good. Let me just kind of to segue from the past. There is no discontinuity between the research on 9/11 and the research on exopolitics. Is actually the same body of research. It's just that you find that there are not that many researchers who are concurrently versed in both areas, even though you'll find specific individuals like Jim Mars are. Jim Mars has written books both in the 9/11 John F. Kennedy and exopolitics area. I'm another such person, and you'll find more and more people are conspiracy research bridges both areas, terrestrial and extraterrestrial related conspiracies. And so the type of books that you read in both areas are identical. And the cast of characters is identical. So there's not that much of a difference.
I mean, when you study history, I mean, it's just ripe with conspiracy.
Sorry?
When you study history, it's pretty well ripe with conspiracy all
right,
through it.
Right. And so there are a whole I can list a couple of two or three books that that if you got, it would take you pretty rapidly up the learning curve on exopolitics.
So is this...
So shall I go ahead?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. One is by Dr. Michael Salla, S-A-L-L-A, and that is... I just don't know the full titles by memory, but it's something like Exopolitics. I've got it right on my bookshelf. Michael Salla, Exopolitics, Political Implications of the Extraterrestrial Presence. And he is a former professor at the university at American University. And if you read this book, it's available on Amazon. A lot of people who buy his book also buy my book. My book is Exopolitics, Politics, Government, and Law in the Universe. And this will tell you how the apparatus of the exopolitical truth, of the extraterrestrial truth embargo, was set up and essentially managed by the Rockefeller interests through Kissinger, through various committees and groups that were set up immediately following World War II. And it's all fully documented, et cetera.
Okay, the premise go ahead.
Yeah. Another book, and this is for the benefit of yourselves and your listeners, that goes to answer Melody's question, that is, what is the evidentiary base? It's Richard Dolan, and the title of that book, this is a classic, is UFOs and the National Security State. And that, I would call it required reading.
I've never heard of it.
Yeah, I mean it's a world famous book.
Okay.
And that'll take you through the whole thing. I mean, did you know that on July 26, 1952, extraterrestrial vehicles buzzed the UF Capitol and that was front page news and Truman sent the U.S. Air Force after them?
Well, I got into reading a lot of that work that came out of there, but I was reading like Project Blue Book and stuff.
You know, and so the issue is, who are the extraterrestrials and what's their game? That's exopolitics. So the just like in the John F. Kennedy assassination case, you had 126 or more mysterious deaths with all of the witnesses, and it was very, very difficult to get any sustained action on the JFK issue. And books on the John F. Kennedy assassination, you know, it's very difficult to get it through. And when I teamed up with Representative Gonzalez, I then brought in the Assassination Information Bureau from Boston. They were a group of 8 firstborn males. There was a board of directors. And, you know, it was like being a member of the Weather Underground or something. I mean, you know, you had FBI agents coming out of every corner because they didn't want the fact that their active state in doing the false flag operation against and assassinating Kennedy was going to come to public light, but we busted through it. And that's what we're doing in busting through the extraterrestrial truth embargo. So to answer your question personally, what I've done with my professional life and the talents that were given to me is I've busted through truth embargoes. I've done it in Kennedy. I'm doing it in 9/11, and I'm doing the extraterrestrials.
Okay,
and
so
just yesterday we held a press conference for non-governmental organizations at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., with the the Exopolitics Institute, Exopolitics Toronto, my organization, the Institute for Cooperation in Space. Our chairman of the board just passed away about 3 weeks ago, Sir Arthur C. Clarke, who's the inventor of the telecommunication satellite and the author of 40 scientific books and a couple of science fiction ones, such as 2001, A Space Odyssey, and the Institute for Multitrack Diplomacy with Ambassador John McDonnell, who was an ambassador for the U.S. At the U.N. for 17 years. And what we're doing is that there was passed by the U.N. General Assembly in 1978 a decision passed unanimously, let me read it to you.
Okay.
Because I think that it's this is another one of those things that has been hidden. This was a decision that was passed unanimously in 1978, United Nations General Assembly Decision 33-426, invited, quote, member states to take appropriate steps to coordinate on a national level scientific research and investigation into extraterrestrial life, including unidentified flying objects, and, you know, setting up the Secretary General and, you know, establishing a U.N. Office on extraterrestrial issues. Well, the U.S. fought it tooth and nail, and it's lain dormant since 1978, so this is the 30th anniversary of the decision, so we're now going to pick it up and, have the U.N. implement it, and we've asked for a meeting with U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. Probably we'll get it within the next 60 to 90 days to begin briefing the U.N. on these issues. And we've sent letters to the governments of France, the United Kingdom, Mexico, and Brazil, which are among the nations that just in the past several years have begun to release their secret files, their secret extraterrestrial files, where their air forces document encounters with extraterrestrial craft. Now, you ask what sort of proof there is. Well, there's all sorts of photographic, radar proof. Just this past January 8th, 2008, in Stevensville, Texas, we had a mile-long, half-mile-wide extraterrestrial craft come over and came in at a speed of about 2,000 miles an hour and then came to a halt and hovered over the town of Stevensville, Texas, there, and was fully seen by witnesses, was actually photographed with their cell phones, cameras. They testified about it on Larry King Live on CNN. They were trained witnesses. A number of them were law enforcement. And what happened is as the craft was there then, a bunch of F-15s came in pursuit, and the craft just zoop, took off. And the reason why is that Stephenville is within 60 miles of the Texas White House. And so the extraterrestrial craft are playing their little game, which is like, okay, Mr. President, your days are numbered, boop, 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 as they try to get dirty elite out of the, you know, last vestiges of the petroleum nuclear civilization. I mean, if you're, you know, part of a galactic, you know, federation whose civilizations are millions of years in advance of this tiny warlike planet,
Okay, why don't you get into the Disclosure Project a little bit and Wernher von Braun's predictions? So that kind of gives a little background a little bit as to another possibility going on here. And that's where I'm kind of, and I'm, you know, I'm not totally sold on this thing yet. So.
These are different points in the fabric, and they're different openings. Well, as it turns out, you're talking to a person who has a direct connection with both of those, both with Dr. Wernher von Braun and his predictions, and with the Disclosure Project. And I'll start out with Dr. Wernher von Braun, because that's the first that you asked for. My co-director in the Institute for Cooperation in Space is Dr. Carol Rosen, and she heads up our Ecuador office. And she is a remarkable woman who, in her career, she became a protege of Dr. Wernher von Braun, who was a complex character. He was the head of rocketry for the Third Reich, brought over. He was a whistleblower then. He tried to and did organize a number of escapes from the Panamunda camp there. All of these scientists were held with their families under duress at that point during World War II. He was brought over to the U.S. And developed the rocketry program for what we could call the Fourth Reich, the U.S.
Right.
And Carol was the first woman executive in the aerospace industry at Fairchild Industries, where she met Dr. von Braun, who was an executive there at the time, and she became his protege during the latter years of his life. And as he was on his deathbed and dying, he blew the whistle and said, "Look, they're going to be." This was with the collapse of communism. He said, "They're going to be a series of false wars, because all of these wars are kept ongoing with a false enemy." As we were talking about the permanent war economy, its product is war, and you need in the the way the permanent war economy works is through the dialectic of enemies. So you always need an enemy that you need to set up. And with the collapse of communism, they lost the permanent enemy. So he says, first, there's going to be a false war on terror. And he says, and that's going to be set up. And that was 9/11. That's what we're experiencing now. So he blew the whistle on 9/11. And then he said, we're going to have a false war against the asteroids. This is in order to justify the weaponization of space. You make, you know, outer space a really dangerous thing. And then he said, we're going to have a false war against the evil ETs. In other words, that you make the as in Orson Welles' famous evening, mm-hmm. War of the Worlds. Remember that back in 1938, I think, where he had a radio broadcast of War of the Worlds and people committed suicide. Well, you create, just like they've created an artificial terror by creating a false flag operation, an artificial terror event with an Islamic enemy that doesn't exist, that is just a matrix of the false flag operation. You create a false flag operation where you create an evil extraterrestrial threat, and this justifies the weaponization of space and the spending of trillions of dollars, and everybody's fear pictures go to space, and everybody becomes it's global terror and fear, and then you can the permanent war economy has control of everybody's pocketbooks, has control of the governmental apparatus, has control of all of their civil liberties, because there's going to be an evil extraterrestrial presence coming. Well, once you get into exopolitics, you discover that, in fact, there are fleets of what we call ARVs, alien reproduction vehicles. And there's a black budget, and this is thoroughly documented once you get into the research, and this is just an extension of conspiracy research, there's a black budget of $1.5 trillion per year as compared to the $600 billion conventional, you know, what Congress passes every year, military budget. And what that $1.5 billion black budget goes for is for all the exotic weapons and for the fleet of alien reproduction craft. And the black budget has its own fleet of flying saucers.
Yeah, so when you're talking about seeing some of these things, isn't it possible that we're really just seeing a lot of our own?
Of course.
Okay.
Of course. Part of the science of exopolitics is knowing which is ours and which is theirs. I mean, this is so in order to be, you know, I call it just part of civil defense, you know, to really, if you're looking for the next false flag operation, and you know, it's not going to be another 9/11, it's going to be an alien false flag attack. So anybody who's interested in this area, hey, start reading exopolitics, because that's where the next false flag is going to be. And yeah, you can, you know, once you begin to understand and get into that area and into the intricacies of this area, and see, you know what? I mean, I spend my day today. I spent an hour on the phone with a whistleblower from a top secret CIA program, extraterrestrial human liaison program, and the CIA runs extraterrestrial human liaison programs back in 1971. And if you want to know, to answer your question, Melody, why did the Department of Defense shut down our proposed Carter White House extraterrestrial study back in 1977? You think that the president runs the government? You got another thing coming. The reason why they run it down is that the black budget government has ongoing liaison programs with certain types of extraterrestrial civilizations, which are very nasty, and which have given them the technology, you know, to have this worldwide military domination, and they want to keep this secret, and they want to keep the monopoly on these relationships. And our extraterrestrial communication study in 1977 would have run into and discover and blown the whistle on these programs, on this 1971 program. And that's why it got shut down.
So how many scientists and that type are in the Disclosure Project now?
By the way, mm-hmm. if you want to read the evidence of that, go to the Disclosure Project book, and you can read my affidavit and my testimony, because I was a Disclosure Project witness, because I'm the only Disclosure Project witness that submitted a sworn affidavit, because I'm a lawyer and I've submitted sworn testimony, because guess what? Murder will out. And one day, all of this is going to come out, so I have loaded all of this with sworn affidavits, because when this was shut down in 1977, and I was director of the Carter White House proposed 1977 extraterrestrial communication study, I was attacked at the inner ring of the Pentagon while meeting with an assistant secretary of defense with electromagnetic weapons. And I have this fully documented, so that as all of this starts coming up, we're going to be able to bring this to light. Danny Sheehan, who's our general counsel of the Institute for Cooperation in Space, also has a parallel story from 1977 in the Carter administration, where he was admitted to the National Archives and saw artifacts there, kind of a flying saucer with all sorts of kind of extraterrestrial writings and hieroglyphics on its side. But these are kind of the nuts and bolts aspect of it. What I did in the field of exopolitics, and I'm credited with actually originating the field and kind of defining it. What exopolitics is the new political science of outer space. And it's the science of relations between human civilization and other intelligent civilizations in the universe. If we look at the 20th century model of science, what we can call the scientific canon, and that, you know, it was at its apex in the 20th century. The scientific canon was all intelligent life ends at Earth's geostationary orbit. You know, we are it. There is no intelligent life beyond Earth's geostationary orbit. And if you were in any responsible position in the matrix, if you are a government official, if you are an educator, especially in at the university level, or a scientific researcher, if you were in any professional position, and you took a position contrary to this, your career would be ruined. There are many people who have been assassinated. They've been ridiculed following the 1952 Robertson Panel, which was convened by the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency. What the Robertson Panel said, and you can go back to it, we have it online at www.exopolitics.com, is that if any journalist or any publication treats the subject of UFOs or extraterrestrial craft seriously, they are to be targeted, and that journalists and media can only treat them with ridicule. And that's essentially what came out of the 1952 Robertson Panel, and those rules have been in effect and have been enforced continuously since 1952. We had the most recent example in the aftermath of the January 1st, 2008, Stephenville, Texas, extraterrestrial vehicle overflight, when Angelia Joyner, who was a very courageous reporter on the Stephenville newspaper there, began to dig in and really report on this stuff. And then in the aftermath of the sighting, began to report that many of the witnesses to this sighting were now being visited and harassed by men in black, or kind of this strange FBI military intelligence cadre of agents, and told to shut up, and were being visited at night in these terrifying visits by these agents, as a result of which she was summarily fired by the Stephenville newspaper and her computer confiscated. And this is in 2008.
So how many are in the Disclosure Project currently?
Witnesses?
Scientists or whoever?
Yeah. Okay. Just for the benefit of your listeners, the Disclosure Project is a nonprofit organization. It held its first press conference on May 9, 2001, of about 20 top-level former military and governmental witnesses. I was videotaped for that, and at the National Press Club, the we had a live video feed of that press conference. That was the largest audience, live video audience at that time to date. I think over 250,000 people attempted to access it, and it crashed. And we had a professional study done, and it determined that the National Security Agency attempted to shut down that broadcast. And I think to date, Dr. Stephen Greer, who's head of the Disclosure Project, you can go to www.disclosureproject.org, has videotaped over 400 top-level military intelligence and governmental witnesses. These range from, you know, the top-level enforcement of the Federal Aviation Administration, who will talk about, you know, extraterrestrial craft that are a mile wide that, you know, follow along right beside commercial aircraft. And to generals, to other, you know, I've had guests from the Disclosure Project on Exopolitics Radio who have been in the U.S. Navy and are former ABC newsmen who describe extraterrestrial craft a half a mile wide coming up out of the sea right in front of U.S. aircraft carriers. So, you know, and these are fully documented on the top secret U.S. Navy codes and on the radar. So the physical evidence is overwhelming.
So what about the technology that's involved
with
them?
Sorry?
What about the technology that's involved there that we have and that they would have so that we can, you know, to kind of bring this into a little more, I mean, it's things like holographic images you said the electromagnetic weaponry. I know they're getting really huge into robotics.
I don't quite understand your
question. In order for them to be passing, you were interviewing somebody on your program just recently. I can't remember if it was a priest or doctor, started with an L. I can't remember. It was Layden or something.
You know, Melody, you'll have to speak up a bit.
Okay. It was a priest or a Dr. Layden or somebody just within the last few weeks that was on your program. That was speaking about how they kind of come into view and then they kind of disappear. And
well, the phenomenon of phase shifting is well known in among extraterrestrial civilizations and their vehicles. And now, as I understand it, even the most advanced weapons of the that are being developed by the U.S. National Reconnaissance Organization reportedly now have radars that can reach into the next dimension over. And that's what I refer to as upper-dimensional extraterrestrial civilizations. This is where we get into the, you know, all the kind of far-out stuff about parallel universes and dimensions. Well, look, think of ourselves. You know, here we are. We're kind of in the 3D dimension. We're in the third dimension. We're kind of in the fourth dimension. We're in the space-time dimension, okay?
Okay.
The universe is really like a science fiction movie, and it's very, very far out. And we, as humans, are in the dimension of time and space. So we're in the time-space hologram. Now, that gives us the ability to access any point in the time-space hologram to go, say, from point ABCD to point EFYG. ABCD would be where, say, all three of us are now occupying this particular point in time-space, talking on this radio program. You all are, you know, in your spaces, and I'm in my space, and we're talking into the radio transmitter of WHEN, and that's all being heard by our listeners. That's a particular point in time-space, but it's inside a dimensional universe. It's a self-contained universe. And that's kind of all that we know, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Well, guess what? It looks like there are universes that are kind of in the next universe over, or dimensions that are in the next dimension over. And scientists began to discover this with the discovery of string theory. And it appears as though that, quote, upper dimensional civilizations, as civilizations evolve, they are more advanced beings, have access to wider realities than our own. And in coming down into our reality, they can materialize into our time-space reality, either by time-traveling into it, because all space travel eventually becomes time travel. The only way that you can, quote, travel the long distances of space because of the many billions of light years between our various constellations and stars and galaxies, is in fact to collapse space and travel through time, through wormholes.
So is that what they're kind of trying to do right now? I've heard them talking about doing some kind of black hole work. Are you familiar with
that? Uh-huh. And actually, all of this is happening. And inside the black budget, there is, on the terrestrial level, there is very advanced research with regard to teleportation, with regard to time travel, and with regard to space-time travel, and with regard to a space fleet. There are technologies that exist inside the black budget, zero-point energy and free energy technologies, that if released would virtually transform our world into, a free energy world and get it out of the world of war, disease, crime, and poverty that we have. They are now caught inside that trap of the permanent war economy, which seeks enslave the human spirit. And exopolitics has as its objective the liberation of humanity and the reintegration of this planet and of human society into the society of inhabited planets, and into extraterrestrial civilizations. And upon study, it appears as though there is actually an integrated outreach toward planet Earth by a higher plan of extraterrestrial civilizations, to awaken our planet to the presence of extraterrestrial civilizations, to the fact that humanity lives in a populated universe, and to the fact that we can let go of the permanent war economy and move into a higher plane of existence. And that's the path for a positive human future that exopolitics and an interactive future between human society and extraterrestrial civilizations offers.
Well, let me just throw something in from the side, if you don't mind, Alfred.
Sure.
I live in Crestone, Colorado, and there's a lot of Buddhists here. And,
yeah.
Of course, they're following the teachings of the Buddha as best they can and meditating and trying to kind of break through some mental barriers. Would you say that there's any connection whatsoever between what Buddhists are trying to do and what you're talking about in terms of dimensions?
Oh, yeah. Very, very much. I'm looking at my office here, and I have a picture of the Dalai Lama meeting with the Hopi elders,
mm-hmm.
and with my friend Thomas Banyaka before he passed away. And if you get deeply inside Tibetan Buddhism, you will find that they have a very developed exopolitical knowledge, which is kept in there, which is a knowledge of how the dimensions are organized. I mean, even the basic Buddhist teachings, which talk about the afterlife dimensions and the various bardos and the path of the soul and the reincarnation cycle is in effect an exopolitical model, because what exopolitics describes is the full multidimensional universe, both the inner and the outer, in which we live in a dimensional universe. Now, for many millennia, human civilizations have tended to treat the various extraterrestrial visitors as, quote, gods. And we have many of the human religions, in fact, have been founded by extraterrestrial visitors. If we look at Judaism, it is highly probable that events such as the burning bush and the 12 tablets of Moses and Yahweh himself was an extraterrestrial. If we look at Islam, it is highly probable that the channelings that Muhammad experienced were extraterrestrial channelings. If we just had a trilogy of books come out by historians and scientists in Portugal showing that the Fatima, in terms of Catholicism and Christianity, that the, quote, Fatima miracles, the supposed Virgin Mary sightings at Fatima, were in fact a UFO encounter. These are extraterrestrial encounters. If you go back to the Mormons here, things that we call the angel Moroni, quote, end of quote, these are probably extraterrestrial, multidimensional encounters. So these are areas that the exopolitical model, really begins to address, and probably Buddhism is amongst the world's most advanced, the world's most advanced religions, and we've worked very closely with Buddhism. My wife was in Maui just a short while, about a year ago, with the Dalai Lama, and I've my life is intertwined around with his. And actually, in 1982, I was in the upper floors of the United Nations building there just by synchronicity, and I happened upon the Hopi elders and helped them find their meeting, and they were fulfilling the prophecy in the House of Micah so that the gourd of ashes wouldn't fall. And the House of Micah is, of course, the glass house, the United Nations. The gourd of ashes is the atomic bomb. And I kind of did my little bit in helping fulfill that the atomic bomb wouldn't fall by helping the Hopi elders deliver their prophecy. So we all kind of, wander down this path, and the Dalai Lama, who has established his International Peace Center here in Vancouver. We were with him here in Vancouver when he gave his series of talks about 18 months ago, establishing the center. Is very much of an exopolitical actor in our sense.
Well, how do you deal with the fact that, okay, the UN was started by the Rockefellers, and with particularly with the land being donated by them, and then having the elites control so much, how would we be able to overcome, that control?
Yeah, that's the UN.
Well, no, that's a fair question. Sort of put yourself in the position of, say, an extraterrestrial ambassador who is inside of a human body and has landed here on the planet. Well, what would you do? You would take all the different steps that you could to help bring about a condition whereby the permanent war economy would be deconstructed. And one of the avenues that you would take would be to try and work within the UN as a specific organization. Now, that's not the only avenue within which we work. I mean, I understand as full well as you do how controlled the UN is. I've been a non-governmental organization delegate to the UN since the 1980s. I was a delegate to the second special session on disarmament. On the other hand, our Institute for Cooperation in Space was founded at the Innospace Conference in Vienna, Austria, in 1982, where Dr. Carol Rosen, Sir Arthur C. Clarke, and I met. So there are all these, it has a greenhouse effect. Now, if you look at, our proposal then is to use the rule of law. After all, it was all of these nations in 1978 which passed the resolution unanimously as part of the General Assembly to investigate extraterrestrial life and establish a UN department for unidentified flying objects and extraterrestrial affairs. The background of that, of how that occurred, is a really interesting exopolitical chapter, and that is that the Prime Minister of Grenada in 1978 was Sir Eric Gary, who was himself a UFO contactee. And right before his going to the United Nations and bringing the resolution to the floor, which was eventually unanimously adopted, a group of Grenadian fishermen came to him, and they had found the body of an 8-foot-long extraterrestrial that had washed up to the shores, and that was brought to the Grenadian Medical School, University of Grenada Medical School, and put there for examination. Well, then Eric Gary went forward to the UN as a matter of conscience. This was in 1978, where coincidentally there was a meeting with Kurt Waldheim, who was then the UN Secretary General, with a whole series of scholars and researchers from around the world who wanted the UN to address the extraterrestrial issue. He, because he was the head of state, had the authority to go on the floor and to bring this resolution to the General Assembly. Although the U.S. attempted to block it, there were a number of nations such as India, who for many thousands of years in the Hindu traditions have, if you go back in the Vedas, I mean, there's all kinds of extraterrestrial craft that are flying around in the Vedas, and that's knowledge that has been known for thousands of years. So the India and a number of other countries championed the resolution, and fortunately it passed unanimously. But then the CIA and the United States kept up their chicanery, and on a second trip, Eric Gehry was scheduled to go back to New York and meet with Kurt Waldheim, the then Secretary General of the United Nations, who had an extreme interest in extraterrestrials, probably from his days as a Nazi officer, because the Nazis were aided and abetted by a certain civilization of extraterrestrials, once you get deeply into this subject. While he was in New York, right before that meeting, the CIA engineered a coup in Grenada, overthrew the government of Eric Gehry, and installed Maurice Bishop as the interim president. So Eric Gehry, because he had brought this resolution to the United Nations, was therefore overthrown. But that's not even the end of the chapter. If you want to investigate why the United States, with all of its military omnipotence, invaded the island republic of Grenada in the Reagan administration, you can actually study that and find out that the invasion of Grenada, which was carried out under the pretext that Cuban construction crews that were constructing the air base were actually going to take over the island, thereby endangering the U.S. medical students at the University of Grenada medical group, was all a cover for the U.S. invasion of Grenada in order to capture the body of the extraterrestrial that was at the University of Grenada medical school. So that's the hidden history of...
I'm surprised that they didn't do that covertly instead of so over. I'm surprised they didn't do that more covertly, as opposed, because that seems to be our modus operandi, as opposed to doing it such an overt invasion.
You know, I think that there's something about the United States that is psychopathic. Tell it to the people of Iraq. Tell it to the people of Afghanistan. You know, they 1/4 of the people of Afghanistan are now dead. Since the year 2000, since September 11, 2001, which was invaded on the pretext of 9/11, which was an operation of U.S. military intelligence, and they have been sacrificed in a war of genocide. Ask anybody in the United States, except those people who are conscious, if they care, and you will not find anybody who cares. You have both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. Yes, yeah, we have to finish off the war in Afghanistan. What? Kill the remaining 3/4 of the people? For a war that you started with your false flag operation, I'm sorry. You know, the U.S. is still a genocidal country, and that is the truth. And once you get deeply into exopolitics and open yourself up and start reading what the extraterrestrial civilizations are saying about the U.S., maybe the U.S. citizens will wake up and start taking responsibility, because at some point, the judgment is going to come due, and you know, this country has participated in vast war crimes, and the elite of the U.S. knows that they're doing it in violation and against the wishes of the combined presence of advanced extraterrestrial civilizations. The elite of the world are holding the world hostage, and they're manipulating the people of the United States and the U.S. population to keep everybody into fear and keep everybody fighting wars and slaughtering everybody up as part of an intentional global depopulation policy. It's called the scorched earth policy. This is a very sorry scene. And it has a deep, deep exopolitics meaning. I urge you and all of your listeners to read these exopolitics book and get into the deeper story of what's going on Earth. I call it the ABC future. A for Armageddon, B for to be or not to be. That is, are we going to allow an extinction-level event to happen? C for seeing, S-E-E. And it's the see future, where we all can see what the future is, that is the exopolitical future, that I think will allow us all to go forward. You've been more than generous tonight to allow me to express the full, sort of my full opinion, and I really appreciate it, and I want to thank you both.
Well, thank you, Alfred.
We certainly thank you, Alfred. Very stimulating and interesting, and we'll try to find those books. You know, on the other topics, I'm right with you. I've read the same things that make sense. On the exopolitics and the UFOs, I haven't done the reading and don't have the experience that you have, but I'll try to look at those issues and hopefully.
Yeah,
I
think that Buddhism is a very strong and good foundation for branching out into exopolitics.
Okay.
Well,
thank you again for your time and your expertise. It's been very, very stimulating.
And you've got your exopolitics.org, is that correctly?
Well, it's www.exopolitics.com.
Oh, .com. Okay, .org is Dr. Salas, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
And I would urge you to visit .org also. And great.
And I thank you, and we'll have to have you up again sometime and explore this a little bit further.
Well, thank you both.
Okay.
Very much.
Thanks so much, Alfred. Good night.
And all the best to the listeners at WHEM.
Okay. Thank you. This is KHEN 106.9 Salida, and we just had...